Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, that's how it's setting up. Let me start right here. There were hints, which started yesterday in an interview that a longtime IOC member did with USA Today. That member in question told that paper, quote, "On the basis of the information the IOC has, postponement has been decided. The parameters going forward have not been determined, but the games are not going to start on July 24th. That much I know." End quote. Now, for some reason, whenever this particular, extremely well-respected IOC member speaks, people seem to get lost in the sauce. They forget about what he is saying, and they focus only on this guy's name. Yes, I will grant you this. It is a pretty interesting name. I know. I'm aware. I've heard that name before. He is one of the most respected figures in international athletics. He was an Olympic swimmer, a five-time Canadian national champion, a four-time medalist at the Commonwealth Games. He helped found the World Anti-Doping Agency. Time magazine has hailed him as one of the 100 most influential people in the entire world. So when this particular guy speaks, you should listen. And yet, despite that resume, all anybody wants to do is laugh when this guy speaks because of his name. You know who I'm talking about by now, right? This guy's name is Richard William Duncan Pound. And yes, he goes by Dick Pound. Yeah, I got it. That's hilarious. That's really funny. You can get over it right about now, second graders. Yes, I know his birth name is Richard, and that he could easily go by Richard, or Rick, or Rich, or Ricky, or Richie. But he doesn't. And what's your point? This isn't news. The guy is in the news at least every 2 years when there is an Olympics, and usually more than that, and yet every single time, people react like it's the first time they've ever heard of this guy. Every single time, people are busting a gut laughing about his name. If he speaks to the media, he'll trend on Twitter, and every tweet will be somebody cracking up over his name. I mean, grow up already. Get over it. And yes, I'm sure he's aware you're all laughing. Just as I'm sure he doesn't give a damn. This guy doesn't care. That's why he's a badass. But this is not about some guy's name. This is about the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo and the fact that Mr. Pound was giving the hint yesterday, and then today it did become official. The IOC released a statement a few hours back that read in part, quote, "In the present circumstances and based on the information provided by the WHO today, the IOC president and the prime minister of Japan have concluded that the games in Tokyo must be rescheduled to a date beyond 2020, but not later than the summer of 2021, to safeguard the health of the athletes, everybody involved in the Olympic Games, and the international community," end quote. And there it is. There you have it. Finally, the 2020 Olympics are going to be held in 2021. They'll be held in 2021 and still called the 2020 Olympics. Good, right? That's the right call. That's a no-brainer. A truly and thoroughly complicated no-brainer, but a no-brainer nonetheless. See, unlike a regular professional sports league, postponing the Olympics is not as simple as just suspending things for a few months and then picking it right back up. This is not something where you start a phone tree, get the word out to everybody, and then meet up in the park for a rescheduled Olympics a few months later. Like, the Olympic Games are on a totally different scale. According to USA Today, for instance, the operating budget for these Olympics is already closing in on $13 billion, with a B, $13 billion. That is a massive endeavor. And doing anything that changes it is also a massive endeavor. Like, it's not like the Clippers or the Lakers playing at Staples, and they just need to make sure that the arena is free into July, August, and maybe later so they can play those games. In the case of the Olympics, it's not just a matter of will the arena be free in 2021. In some cases, the arenas are not supposed to exist in 2021. Like, some of the Olympic venues are effectively pop-ups, and they get taken down after the games, or they're scheduled to be converted into something else. Now you have to decide if they'll stay up for a year longer, or if you'll take them down and then put them back up in a year. This is why this is a logistical nightmare. Like, the Olympic Village was supposed to be converted into apartments after the games, and some of those units have already been sold. And that's before we get into all the other competitions around the globe, like the 2021 World Track and Field Championships in Eugene, Oregon. They'll now be thrown off or eliminated altogether because the Olympics is moving a year later. So how does that work now? That's what they're going to have to try to figure out. And that's why they've been a lot slower than regular professional leagues to make this move, because they were probably hoping that it wouldn't come to this, and they waited as long as they possibly could, but it did. Like, there was no way they could go ahead with the Olympics this summer. Countless athletes in countless countries have had their training impacted by coronavirus, and they've got no idea when they'd be able to get back to regular training. Schedules for the Olympic trials have been thrown off. So, preparing for the Olympics, either as the host country or as an athlete, is never easy, and it's even more challenging in the face of a global pandemic. But even if you could sort out all the training and all the Olympic trials, and you could get everybody safely to Tokyo for those games, then you've got the matter of the games themselves. And the fact that you'd be gathering thousands of people from around the world in the same spot for a couple of weeks in the summer during a global pandemic. I mean, that would be one of the most absurd, dangerous things ever. So I will say it again. I've said it before, and I'll say it here. The moral of the story is, when Mr. Pound speaks, you listen. It will be a logistical nightmare to not hold them as scheduled, but much better than the actual nightmare of holding them as scheduled. The Olympics make the NBA, NHL, NFL, and MLB look nimble by comparison. Those massive sports leagues are like speedboats compared to the Olympics. In other words, postponing the games will be like turning around the Titanic, but going ahead with them would be like letting the Titanic steam right into the iceberg.
Iceberg, run ahead!
If you see me working. It's a logistical nightmare to postpone the games, but so much worse to try and pull them off as scheduled. Seth Wickersham is my guest. Seth, it is good to have you back in the jungle. How are you?
Hey, Jim. It's great to be here. Longtime fan.
I know. Great to have you back, Seth. Me too. Mutual respect to you. So you've got this great piece up right now about the relationship between Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, and the Patriots. You make the point that this is not something that just happened last week. It's been a long time in the making. So if you could, Seth, go way back. November 2001, you and Brady had a meeting at the old Foxborough Stadium. What were your impressions of Brady at that time?
Yeah, well, we met, and, you know, we were both about a year out of college, and that was a slight bond. And the thing to me was just how much confidence he had in the ability to play football. He said, you know, the game has always come easy to me, and that was surprising because, you know, he's a sixth-round pick. And then the second thing that struck me was just how deeply he cared about his craft in a way that I thought was different than other people. It almost felt like there was an element of self-actualization that the game brought to him. And as we were leaving, he looked at the stadium, Gillette Stadium, which was under construction. And he looked over at it and he said, you know, I hope I get to play there one day. And it's crazy to think about now that, you know, way back when he was thinking about, you know, will I even have a chance to play in that stadium? It's a crazy contrast to think about now in respect to where he is.
No question. Seth Wickersham is joining us. So, Seth, the root of the split between Brady and the Patriots, of course, does not go all the way back to 2001. Before we get into the moments where that relationship started to fray permanently, how would you describe the relationship between Brady and Belichick when it was at its very best? I mean, were they ever especially close?
Well, they were close business associates, and, you know, it was always a business relationship with them, and it's one of the things that Bill Belichick has been so successful at is separating the personal relationship from the business relationship, and he has, you know, done it ruthlessly on a level that no head coach has ever done it, And that was always going to create a tension with Tom Brady's stated goal of playing until he was in his mid-40s. He started doing that about a decade ago. I mean, it sounds crazy. Maybe not quite a decade ago, but he started doing it a while ago. And at the time, I think even people in the building didn't think that he was going to play until he was in his mid-40s, that they would never have to cross that bridge. But sure enough, I mean, he got better. The Patriots were looking, you know, beyond Tom Brady in 2013, even in 2014 when they drafted Jimmy Garoppolo. But Tom got better. And there was always going to be an inherent tension between Bill Belichick's genius and knowing when to move on from a guy, never paying for past performance, and Tom Brady's longevity. You know, his dad once told me he's going to be a modern-day George Blanda. That's how he's handled his career, and it was always going to be a problem in New England.
We are talking to Seth Wickersham. All right, Seth, so there are a bunch of bumpy moments, such as Deflategate, the TB12 method issues, but if you had to point to a moment or a time when it started to fracture, when would you say that was, and what was it about?
Well, I think that there was, like, a lot of things over the course of 20 years. It's kind of amazing that it lasted that long, but I think that, you know, you go back to the fall of 2017. There were some issues in the building surrounding, you know, the TB12 method in his business and Alex Guerrero, his trainer. But, you know, at the heart of what Tom Brady wanted at that time was a contract extension. He wanted a commitment, and he preferred it to be with the Patriots. But if they didn't want to commit to him, I think he was okay leaving. He just wanted some clarity. And that issue never went away. It continued into August of 2018. Remember, he skipped the entire offseason program. And then August of 2019, last August, he reportedly almost left camp because he was so frustrated with the way the contract negotiations were going. And so I think that when that happened and he was able to void out of his career, everybody knew it. I think that that's the opportunity that he exploited. And so, you know, when you ask, like, you know, what have been the issues, there have been some bumps in the road, but at the end of the day, it was the same thing. He wanted a commitment to from whatever team he was playing for that would allow him to play until he was in his mid-40s, and the Patriots were only willing to go year to year.
Seth Wickersham is joining us. You know, so you also make the point, Seth, that Brady wanted to feel valued. He wanted to love the work that he was doing, and at the risk of getting way too deep into the psychology of all this, is Belichick unable to do that, or is Belichick simply unwilling to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's unwilling to. I think that he, you know, it'll be a question that I'll try to answer at some point. But, you know, when he learned the discipline to just be emotionless in terms of how he would deal with current players on the roster and, you know, how he took that to an extreme is a fascinating story. I don't know exactly when it happened for him. But because of it, you know, Brady was always a special case. We all knew that. I mean, he'd always talk about, you know, how he's just another Patriot and Belichick would coach him like he's just another Patriot. But everybody knew that he was a little bit different, right? I mean, he'd negotiate contracts like he did in 2013 alone with Robert Kraft on a plane from Boston to L.A. But at the end of the day, Robert Kraft was the one who was going to let Bill Belichick drive the negotiations here. And Bill was only willing to go to year to year. He's never going to pay for past performance. And even though we were warned over the years, I mean, Tom Brady Sr. has been very clear that it was going to end poorly in New England. I think everybody thought that it might not, that there might be another exception here for him, and there just wasn't.
We are talking to Seth Wickersham. So, Seth, go to Bob Kraft for a minute. You brought him up. When he says that Brady came to his house last week and, quote, "I thought he was coming over as he has for the last 10 years to quietly get things done," end quote, what do you make of that comment? I mean, do you think that he actually believed that that was going to happen, or is he just trying to put a nice spin on it?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of both there. I thought that the thing that was interesting about it was that he had, you know, found a way through media channels to make clear that Bill was going to be the one driving this negotiation. And, you know, there's a lot of people who took that as putting this thing in Belichick's lap so that, you know, people blame him when Tom leaves. That's a level of detail I don't quite have yet. But I thought it was a very revealing comment. And whether it was spin or whether he, you know, was doing it as a way to kind of absolve himself of it, we'll see. I just don't know.
Seth Wickersham is joining us. He's a senior writer at ESPN and Outside the Lines. His latest piece is the story behind the split of Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, and the Patriots. He joins us for a few more moments. You know, Seth, in terms of other strange psychological moments, how do you explain the connection between Tom Brady and Antonio Brown, given all of Brown's truly troubling behavior?
Truly troubling. And I thought that was one of the most interesting things, is that, you know, when the Patriots lost Rob Gronkowski, they lost this matchup nightmare. I mean, nobody could cover that guy, even when they put two players on him. And so it left a huge hole in the offense. And the Patriots filled it with Antonio Brown, who had just been released from Oakland and, you know, had a bunch of bizarre behavior there. Brady takes him under his wing. I was startled with how close they were. I mean, you know, Antonio Brown was living at Brady's house, and it only lasts one game. And I think that that was like another moment that just showed that this thing, you know, was just not going to work. I mean, I think that Bill wanted to keep Antonio Brown, even though in the end it appeared to be that he was on board with releasing him after, you know, Brown went off the rails after only being in New England for 2 weeks. But I think that, you know, that relationship to me has always been a little bit of a mystery. And I think that at the end of the day, Tom thought that, you know, look, if I keep this guy under my wing, yeah, he's troubled, but I can keep him close to me. He can produce on the field, and we'll have a pretty dynamic offense. Antonio Brown gets released, and you just saw the Patriots struggle to get open. And, you know, I know that there's a lot of spin that comes out of New England that, you know, everything that they struggle with on offense is always the surrounding cast. It's never Tom Brady. I mean, some of the coaches who looked at Tom Brady and evaluated him, you know, didn't necessarily agree with that all the time. But, you know, robbed the Patriots of a matchup nightmare, and I think that it's fair to say that a lot of their receivers struggled to get open, and the Patriots just weren't as difficult to defend this year. I mean, he told NBC at the middle of the year, "I'm the most miserable 8-0 quarterback in the NFL." That was a startling and revealing comment.
It was. Seth Wickersham is joining us. I'm picking my spot, Seth, because you've been so good with your time. What is your sense of how the Patriots would evaluate Brady internally right now? What kind of conversations would they have, and what do they think about him right now in terms of playing?
Well, I don't know exactly how they feel about every throw that he could make, but clearly they value him as a year-to-year quarterback because that's what they offered him. And that, to me, says it all. I mean, Ian O'Connor, my colleague, wrote in his book Belichick that came out, I think, 2 years ago, he quoted one of the coaches saying, like, look, I think we could win games with any of 15 top quarterbacks in the NFL. I mean, we know that there wouldn't be Hall of Famers, but we think we could make it work. And the genius of the Patriots has always been finding a winning game plan no matter who's on the roster. I mean, we've seen it happen time and time and time again. Brady was always the exception to that. He was a backstop. He was the guy who could, you know, cover up for everybody's mistakes, 5 Super Bowl wins where they were trailing or tied in the fourth quarter. But clearly, I think that Rams Super Bowl, I think that very last one, showed the Patriots that we can win a Super Bowl with the offense, you know, not playing at top form. We don't need 30 points out of an offense to win a Super Bowl. And maybe that provided a little bit of a template and a relief for them going forward, saying like, hey, we value him as a year-to-year quarterback, even if what he wants is a 2-year commitment with, you know, no trade and no qualifiers.
And then, Seth, one final question. Ultimately, what is your sense as to what's driving and motivating Brady in the move to Tampa? In other words, is it to win another ring? Is it to prove Belichick and the Patriots wrong? Or is it something else?
Well, and that's fascinating. I mean, nobody really knows what motivates these truly elite athletes. Like, I remember I once watched the Kobe Bryant documentary, and I asked Brady, you know, hey, does that reflect you? Because it was a real amazing insight into how great athletes prepare. And Brady was like, he's the Mamba. Like, it didn't really have anything to do with him. And so what's driving him? I don't know, but I think that it's the same thing that was driving him back when I met with him in November of 2001. I think that there's just an element of testing himself and self-actualization and what can he accomplish. I think that, you know, Jeff Darlington, my colleague who's been all over this, said it really well. He said, look, Brady's not necessarily looking to resume pad. And that was an amazing statement, because you just think, like, it's a race to a 7th ring. Tom Brady, if he's been about anything, it's been about winning each and every time out. And, you know, but maybe there's some truth to that. I mean, maybe he adjusts some expectations for these last couple of years, and he wants something just different out of football than what he's had for the previous 20. You know, we'll see. If the Bucs start 1-4, we'll see. I don't know. But that's what I think right now.
All right, so quickly, lost in all the hype of Tom Brady going to the Bucs, is the fact that Drew Brees is coming back as well with the Saints. And the fact that the Saints just added Emmanuel Sanders. I mean, damn, that's a really nice pickup for New Orleans. On the one hand, you can make the argument that the Saints really didn't exactly need to make the offense even more explosive. But on the other hand, check the numbers. They seem extremely explosive, and they are. Michael Thomas had an NFL record 149 receptions last season. You probably knew that. But did you know, do you know who the Saints receiver is with the second most receptions? Do you know who that is? And do you know how many he had? Ted Ginn. Ted Ginn Jr. with 30. And I did not misspeak. The Saints' second most productive receiver had 30 receptions. 30. As in one more than 29. Less than two receptions per game in that offense. A Drew Brees quarterbacked offense. A Sean Payton coached offense. Your second leading receiver had 30 receptions. How's that even possible? And it's a massive drop-off from your number one to your number two. A 119 reception drop-off. Yeah, I mean, I get that Alvin Kamara had 81 receptions. I understand that helps. But they also need something else outside. They need something else at receiver. And the answer was not going to be just running it back with Ted Ginn Jr., who's about to turn 35 and is a free agent. They had to do something, so they did. Enter Emmanuel Sanders. So how'd they get this guy? Apparently with a little help from grandma. Sanders said that when free agency began, quote, "One of the first people I talked to was my grandmother. She called me and my aunt was on the phone. It was free agency, which had started. She said, we're praying you go to New Orleans. The Texans had an opportunity. The Cowboys maybe, but she loves that team, the Saints. She loves Drew Brees. She loves Sean Payton. She loves the offense, and she loves to watch them play," end quote. I'm here to tell you, Emmanuel's grandmother has impeccable taste. She knows her football. If she likes Drew Brees, if she likes Sean Payton and that offense, she knows what time it is. She knows what she's talking about. And she probably also knew that Michael Thomas would really benefit from having somebody on the opposite side to take away the attention and the heat from him. And she's probably got some route trees that she wants Emmanuel to look at. Sanders also went on to say that after he'd made his decision, he gave his grandmother a call.
You know, when I called her and told her, she was so excited about it. Not only that, she's excited because it's literally they can drive to the game they wanted. My family is, I don't know how far of a distance it is, but I know when, you know, last year when we played against San Fran, I had like 15 family members drive up, so it can't be that long of a drive. So that's pretty cool to be back down south and be close to my family as well.
That is pretty cool. Definitely cool. And you know the Saints are pumped up because it does address a serious need for them. Now they've got a little more flexibility in terms of what they can do in the draft because getting a receiver is not as urgent. And it was really urgent prior to. I'm not sure what's more amazing about those numbers. The fact that Michael Thomas had 149 receptions or the fact that the second most by a receiver on that team was 30. Why were teams even covering the other receivers? And how was Thomas still able to get nearly a buck and a half for the season? I don't even know the answer to that. But I do know Sanders is a really good addition. First off, you saw what he did with the 49ers when he came over in that trade. And if you didn't see it, know the Saints did. Because Sanders lit them up for 157 yards receiving. And he did this to them.
Garoppolo looking for a deep ball. Going to throw one down the middle for Emmanuel Sanders. He's got it. He was knocked out. He can get up and run. He may have been touchdown. Breaks a tackle. 10, 5, touchdown, San Francisco.
He did that to them. And he did this as well.
They stack Deebo behind Bourne. They give it to Deebo. Now they flip it to Sanders. Sanders wants to throw the ball wide open. Mostert. He's got it. Touchdown, San Francisco.
You know what else is pretty cool? Hearing sports highlights. That's pretty cool too. But I'm not playing that just to play a highlight. I'm playing that to illustrate what Emmanuel Sanders can bring to your offense. He gave Kyle Shanahan a number of different ways to use him. He gives you space. He made everybody else in that offense even more dangerous. He can cause problems for a defense. You think maybe Sean Payton is going to like working with a receiver who can do all of that and then throw the occasional TD pass too? I'm going to go ahead and say yes, he will. He'll enjoy that, and so will Drew Brees. Because as Sanders was telling everybody, when it was official, he's in New Orleans, and he's there to do whatever it is they need him to do.
You know, at the end of the day, like, I'm here to do whatever I got to do. I feel like, you know, I'm a player that if you tell me to go block, I'm going to block, you know. And if you tell me to run this route, I'm going to run it. And I feel like I'll have success in doing it because I put a lot of work in and I stand on my work ethic alone. And if I don't know how to do it, I'm going to work at it and work at it until I get it. So,
hey, whatever it takes. Whatever it takes. And that's what you want to hear from a new signing. That's leadership. I'm here to do whatever they need me to do. I'm here to win football games. And speaking of leadership, for everybody who was falling all over themselves to hype Tom Brady for asking for his teammates' phone numbers, Drew Brees texted Emmanuel Sanders as soon as he signed. So there's yet another reason not to overhype Brady for doing what pretty much every other quarterback in the history of the world does. Taking nothing away from the guy. He's the GOAT. Just stop saying he's the GOAT because when he got to Tampa, the only thing he asked for were his receiver's telephone numbers. Any quarterback would. There's no point in trying to declare a Super Bowl favorite in March, especially this March, but that's a really nice addition for the Saints, and they already had a really nice roster. So sleep on them if you want. Just know I'm not. I love that pickup. Yeah, I guarantee Sean Payton does. And Drew Brees does as well. And Michael Thomas. And Sanders' grandma. And his aunt. Well done. Pete Thamel is my guest. Pete, good to have you back. How you doing?
Hey, Jim, I'm great. Good to be in the jungle in these uncertain times.
No, great to have you in the jungle, Pete, during these uncertain times. Really good to visit with you. So we're in late March right now, Pete, and in any other year, March Madness is underway. Spring football also would be underway. You've got a piece up right now about what college football coaches are thinking about and what they're doing. Overall, as you've spoken to coaches, what was your sense as to how they're handling all of it?
Yeah, you know, Jim, it's funny. I got a piece coming out later this week on Yahoo about first-year coaches and sort of like what they're dealing with. A lot of them don't even have like houses in their cities yet, and just how they're kind of trying to live and arrange. And there's a few different buckets of coach concerns, I guess. The first one right now is academic, and obviously health and safety of their players is first. Let me be very clear about that. Kids have had to scatter campuses. There's obviously a lot of concern for players who go home, and are their families safe? Do they have the right nutrition, et cetera? But in terms of like long term, the future of college sports, et cetera, there's significant academic and financial reverberations that are going to come out of this. And the immediate academic ones are, if you're a high school senior who is a borderline qualifier in terms of getting your core courses in your ACT or SAT, your opportunities to bolster your academic status are going to be very limited. Obviously, the standardized tests in the immediate future have been canceled. It's hard to imagine many, if any more, being scheduled at least to be taken in a traditional classroom setting. So how is the NCAA going to handle, or are they going to give blanket waivers to kids? Are they going to give more leniency to kids who had academic issues? So that was very front of mind for coaches, and they felt like that hadn't been discussed enough in all this. And then there's obviously the current students who are sort of on the edge right now academically, Jim. How are they going to get eligible and get by? And then there's really big picture financial questions that are looming over all of this. And a lot of them are related to the question no one wants to ask, which is, what if there's no football in the fall? And if there's no football in the fall, the fiscal reverberations from that are just going to be devastating for the college athletics landscape.
We were talking to Pete Thamel. So to that point, Pete, like, universities make a lot of money off food and housing. So if they're not having that kind of revenue, and they're not having the revenue that comes from the NCAA tournament, how bad a spot are some schools in right now?
Well, I think they're going to be in really difficult positions. I mean, think about this, Jim. Of the Power Six basketball leagues, there have been zero coaches fired this year. And a lot of that is because there's places that are going to have a difficult time trying to get people. The people who write big checks are the people who are heavily invested in the market, and they're all down 30-something percent right now, or somewhere in that neighborhood. So, and you can't rely on your campus to bail out athletics, because campuses are really going to be going through a financial drain. If refunds have to be given for housing, if refunds have to be given for food. One thing I didn't realize is just how much universities make year to year from room and board and from dining services. It's a large chunk of what schools are doing. I had a source tell me that schools are going to now be admitting more students than they normally do, because they, you know, assuming there's traditional college as we know it next fall, there's going to be there's going to be maybe people more hesitant to go. Like, this is going to just, you know, ripple through our lives in so many different ways, and a lot of those ways are being felt at the bottom line on college campus.
Pete Thamel is joining us once again. All right, Pete, so the ADs themselves are extremely busy because they have to deal with every team that's impacted right now, but what about the football coaches specifically? What are they doing right now?
they've stayed busy too. Like, I talked to Jeff Traylor, the UTSA coach, today, and he said he has 10 calls with current players every day, 10 calls with recruits every day. It's a dead period, so the recruits have to call him. And then 5 calls with boosters, 5 calls with administrators, 5 calls. He said he had 35 calls baseline every day. So they're doing that. But coaches are antsy. The first-year coaches are interesting, Jim, because they don't really know their programs yet. Like, they don't know their kids. Like, they know their names and they've been around them, but they don't really have, like, a deep connection. So Eli Drinkwitz at Missouri told me today, I said, what's worse, the inability to get to know your kids or the inability to practice? And he's like, that's like asking you if you'd rather amputate my arm or my leg.
Right.
So it's tough in a lot of ways for these coaches, just because the ones who are in better shape are the ones who, you know, are in their third or fourth year. The losing spring practice doesn't mean a lot if you're still going to be running the same version of cover two, right? So, or you have a quarterback coming back like Sam Ellinger at Texas. They're still going to be running, you know, primarily the same offense. So, in a lot of ways, it's coaches are busy, depending on, you know, where they are within the build of their program.
Pete Thamel is joining us. So, Pete, so what are the rules right now as it relates to football practices and recruiting at the moment?
So, basically no one's going to have spring practice. And if that has not been formally declared by everyone, it's an inevitability. The places where the rules, there's some vagaries, are in terms of like football related activities. Some coaches I've talked to said they can go on, you know what Zoom is, Jim?
Sure.
Like,
yes.
The video conferencing software, which has certainly entered the mainstream football coach vocabulary in the last 2 weeks. So some position coaches can hold meetings on Zoom. They can have team meetings on Zoom. Other leagues, everything isn't quite mandatory. So, I'm sorry, in other leagues, there's nothing mandatory. So some coaches have told me they're doing tutorials, they're posting them sort of on the internal servers and systems. Like, this is what we would have installed in practice 8 on offense. And that installation is there and available for the players to watch at their leisure in a non-voluntary manner. So, of course, these are football coaches, and they're all paranoid. So everybody's worried that everybody else is getting the edge. And the other facet that's interesting, Jim, is strength coaches. There's a big worry of safety, quite frankly, first of all, right? These kids are, you know, we hope come back in the summer and eventually have to get back in shape to play a football season. It's hard to imagine some of that timeline is not going to be compressed just when you look at the charts and the way this thing's going. So how do you get kids to work out? A lot of them don't have workout equipment. So you have to do sort of full body workouts at home by yourself. And so there's a big onus on the strength coaches. Now, in terms of recruiting, kids can't go to campuses, but coaches are getting on the phone with kids, and that's where, of the probably dozen head coaches I've talked to in the last 4 or 5 days, that's where most of their energy is going right now. Okay, we can't do anything hands-on. Let's build relationships with these recruits. Let's get to know them. Let's get in front of them. Let's, you know, be efficient with our time and use it that way.
You know, if I can't, Pete, I'll double back to the recruiting in a minute, but I want to follow up on one point you made. Can there be a fall season without any practice over the summer? I mean, can teams just show up in August and still safely play in the fall?
I mean, not – well, for you mean with a camp or without a camp?
Without.
Oh, no way. I mean, you just can't. That would just be a huge safety risk to not have any kind of practices to get these kids in shape. I think that would be a hard no on that. There would have to be a minimum, and I don't know. I'm not a doctor or any kind of medical specialist, but you're putting people in harm's way if you're not allowing them, I would say, multiple weeks to get in shape. Like, forget the strategy stuff and forget all that. Like, you need. I talked to a Power 5 AD this week who basically said his biggest priority going forward, and not just for football but for all the sports, is like, you know, making sure mechanisms are in place so kids are in physical shape for the safety of everything. And look, I'm not a doctor and I'm not going to pretend to be, but I would have to think for practices to happen, never mind stadiums full of people, never mind campuses coming back with students, which again are all antithetical to what we're learning helps suppress this virus, but just for, you know, 85 football players and then 50 or so staff members to conduct a college football practice. To me, and again, I don't know anything about anything, I would think all these kids would have to be tested. Because if you bring everybody back and then one person tests positive for the coronavirus, you got to quarantine everybody for 2 weeks and all the progress is. So I would think that, and look, I was watching CNN yesterday like everybody else, and, you know, there's lines of hundreds of people outside emergency rooms in New York City that, you know, can't get tested, and we're worried about testing, you know, thousands of college football players. It's just so low on the priority list right now. And I look, nobody's hoping more than me that we get there and we can have sports back and we can have football back, but there's just so many things societally right now that we need to focus on and take care of before we can have football back.
Yeah, it's interesting, Pete, because I agree with you. I agree with everything you just said, and it seems almost irresponsible to even pose the question because there's so many more pressing issues than when are we going to see college football once again. I don't even know whether or not I'm supposed to ask the question. But, like, if you look at where things stand right now and the way you just laid it out, what is the earliest that you could see college football teams getting back together again? I know it's not the priority, but realistically, what is the earliest that that could happen?
I just think it's too early to say, and I'm not the right guy to say it. Mm-hmm. So I would just say this. This is what I feel comfortable saying, Jim. If people in their mind don't think they're – people in their mind are like, oh, there'll be football this summer and this fall. Oh, that's definite. I'm comfortable saying that there's nothing definite about that. Like, we need to really – take a look at, you know, like the prospect at the very least of a fall without football.
He is a national college football and basketball reporter for Yahoo Sports, co-host of the Yahoo Sports College podcast as well, Pete Thamel. Pete, well done. Always good to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
Hey, Jim. Thank you.
Just about every single day, whether there are games or not, because the Knicks are that easy to clown. It's fishing in a barrel with dynamite. It is that easy. I could take whatever latest headline or blunder they've had, because they have one virtually every single day. I can riff on that for a few minutes, throw in some horrible music from JD and the Straight Shot, and I can call that a segment or an hour or a show. But like I said, it's so lazy. It'd be way too easy. So I have to hold off and restrict myself and discipline myself to only doing it when there's something that is especially notable or especially egregious. You know, like Stan Van Gundy. Like Stan Van Gundy being asked whether he would be interested in coaching the Knicks or not. Somebody did run that back to him and ask him, and he swatted that shot into the rafters. His reaction to the idea of being the head coach of the Knicks was like a Dwight Howard impression of SVG.
What are you guys doing? Dwight, you gotta catch the ball with two hands.
That was Dwight Howard way back in the day doing an impression of Stan Van Gundy. I'm guessing he would sound exactly like that if you said to him, hey, Stan, you got time? You're looking for an opportunity? Why don't you coach the Knicks? Like, normally a head coach who's asked about the Knicks job would try and do something graceful. and not answer the question. Maybe they say something about how the job's not open or it would be inappropriate to comment on that. Not SVG. Van Gundy told ESPN Radio, quote, "I'm not really interested in the New York Knicks. No. First of all, there's a family history there. If anyone would be interested in that, and I'm not sure he is either, it would be my brother."
Brother.
End quote. All right, so that makes a little bit of sense. You don't want to go where your brother had been the head coach. Maybe you leave an opening for him in the event that he wants it and you focus on other jobs. But what if that wasn't the case? Is there any other reason why you might not be interested in being the head coach of the New York Knicks? Well, as long as you're asking, yes. Van Gundy's like, yes. Now that you bring it up, there is another reason. Van Gundy said, quote, "And number two, I've said this. I'm different than a lot of coaches in looking at jobs. To me, it's all about who you work for and who you work with. Everything that I've seen over the last few years with that organization says that it is extremely dysfunctional." End quote. Bam! Have some. SVG giving JD a straight shot. Dunked on him. Dunked on his head. I haven't seen somebody dunk on the Knicks that disrespectfully since Scottie Pippen posterized Patrick Ewing and then stepped over him and stood over him. Most people would politely decline to answer the question, or they would just dance around it, or say it's not something that's really on their radar, or they would just stop after the first part of the answer when Stan said he was not interested in that job because of family history. But that's not Van Gundy. That's not Stan Van Gundy. He said that, and he wanted to make something really clear, that the Knicks are extremely dysfunctional. Not dysfunctional, not going through a rough patch, not in need of a culture change. No, they're extremely dysfunctional. Look, somebody calling the Knicks extremely dysfunctional is not exactly breaking news. I've done that for years. But a respected NBA head coach calling an NBA organization extremely dysfunctional is pretty significant. Like NBA head coaches, who, especially ones who are between things, NBA head coaches, and particularly those that are in between stints as a head coach, are notorious for never saying anything critical about teams and organizations because they do not want to burn any chance they might have at getting the next gig. You don't want to do that because somebody looking at you might think, damn, if he's going to light them up like that, what happens if we hire him and then something goes wrong? He'll do the same to us. This is why coaches in that position usually are not good color commentators or analysts because they're always holding back. They're thinking about the next paycheck while collecting the current paycheck. And the last thing you want to do is say or do anything that's going to eliminate you from consideration for that next gig. Except for Stan Van Gundy. He doesn't give a damn.
I don't have an answer for that.
Thanks, Siri.
Is there something else I can help with?
No. He doesn't care about that. Wow. The robots are taking over. Van Gundy doesn't give a damn. At least he doesn't give a damn as it relates to the Knicks. He wants you to know how little he thinks of the Knicks and how dysfunctional they really are. And if saying that means that the Knicks are going to eliminate him as a coaching candidate, great. You're doing this guy a favor. You were never on his list anyway. And maybe if he says it out loud enough times, the team won't bother him with a telephone call. And if he's saying it, you know pretty much every other coach who matters is thinking it. How could they not? Have you seen the list of head coaches that they've run through at MSG in the last few decades? Some of the best minds in basketball took jobs there and could not find success there. That extremely dysfunctional organization has chewed up and spit out some of the more promising head coaches and even potential Hall of Famers and members of the Hall of Fame. It doesn't matter who you are or what your track record has been, the Knicks are kryptonite. Like Nicktonite. Hey-o! Phil Jackson, take a seat, old man.
Phil Jackson.
Larry Brown, not here. David Fizdale.
Take that for data.
Respected assistant. Not here, you aren't. Spike Lee. You can get a taste of artist function as well, Spike. How's that grab you? How's that taste, Spike? That PR wizard that the team hired, who then had a PR disaster in his first appearance. Yeah, you too, dude. Whatever worked in the past will no longer work when you get to Madison Square Garden. Every coach knows that. SVG is the only one with the guts to say it publicly and not to back down from it. There are only 30 head coaching opportunities, but in SVG's mind, there are really only 29 because there's no way he would ever take that job. And at this point, neither will anybody else who matters even a little, because they are extremely dysfunctional. He just lit them up. 1-800-636-8686. I could do it every single day, but I have to show discipline and pick my spots, and only when it's especially egregious. That's an example of it being especially egregious.
I don't have an answer for that.
Thank you, Siri. She didn't, did she? That's all right, Siri. I wasn't talking to you anyway. How many of you do that? How many of you have the bleep Siri mode on? Are you afraid that Big Brother's watching, that they hear every single conversation?
Brother.
Most people I know are. Most people I know are. I'm not. Maybe I should be, but I should probably just turn it off so that stops happening.
I don't have an answer for that.
You never do. She never does. He is Shaq Barrett. Shaq, it's great to have you on. How are you?
Oh, thanks for having me on.
It is great to have you on. I appreciate your time, and I appreciate you. It take me back about a year. I want to start right there, because last year at this time, you signed with the Tampa Bay Bucks. What kind of emotions were you feeling at that time, and then what kind of expectations did you have for the 2019 season?
So initially when I was signed, and it was something that I knew was going to happen, like I knew I was going to be out of Denver after last season. So it was something I was looking forward to, but it was still hard to do. I had to, like, the moving and relocating and everything was hard, but ever since day one, they welcomed me down here, and I've been enjoying it. I've been loving it. They've been loving me. And goals coming in was just to first to earn a starting spot and then just to produce double-digit sacks and just be better than I was all around last year.
Right, so Shaq, you knew that probably you were going to take on an opportunity someplace else, but maybe in the very beginning you didn't know exactly where that was going to be. What was it about the opportunity in Tampa that got you excited? Why did you think that was a good fit?
Honestly, I was thinking Cincinnati at first, because Cincinnati was always giving me more money, and I wanted more security for my family, but that, like, they ended up pulling it off, and that fell through. So Tampa, like, they were still there. They still wanted me, and I'm like, I want to be there now. And once that happened, I was, like, all on board with Tampa, and it ended up being a blessing in disguise, and it worked out the way it's supposed to work out.
Shaq Barrett joining us. It's worked out great. Now, you had not been a regular starter in Denver. Then you got the chance with the Bucks, and then all you did was start every single game, lead the league with 19.5 sacks. When you look back on last season, what kind of thoughts do you have, and what do you remember most?
Yeah, last season was just crazy. Like, just to come on and the way that I came on, like after not starting and then coming in and having 19.5 sacks leading the league, it was just mind-blowing, but it felt like that all my preparation from my previous 5 years led up to this time, just keep working through, persevering through everything, just give it my 100%, and then my opportunity came. I was ready, and I put the work in so I could be able to take off, and I was able to take off, and it's like, it's just still crazy to just think about, like that large jump that I made from five to year six, and yeah, it's still mind-blowing to me, but it was the opportunity and the preparation all in perfect timing.
Shaq Barrett joining us. I was going to ask you about that preparation, because your journey to this point is amazing. When you and I spoke a few years back, we touched on some of this, but I don't know if people truly appreciate the work that you've put in. You were undrafted out of college. You spent 16 of the 17 weeks on the Broncos practice squad your first year, but you just kept working. You kept grinding. How much did you learn and grow during those first few years in Denver?
Oh, I think that set me up perfectly to where I needed to be at right now. Like, coming in, I wanted to get drafted. I wanted to contribute on defense right away. But, like, hindsight, like, I wasn't ready my first year. Like, practice squad was probably the best thing, like, that they had, for me, I'm happy practice squad was invented because it helped me earn a spot on the team next year, and it helped me just learn and grow and be in practice going against the starting tackles and watching Vaughn and then go Vaughn and beware practice and trying to do moves, their version, my version of their moves, and doing it against the starting tackle. So it did help me learn a lot, help me build a lot of everything, pass rush moves, everything, my run game, defense, everything was able to improve over them first few years on practice squad. I wanted my role to increase year 4 or 5, but it ended up working out perfectly.
We are talking to Shaq Barrett. Now, Shaq, the coaches in Tampa rave about you, but you also amaze them. Dan Pompey has this great piece on you where Larry Foote, who coached the linebackers, talks about how you're the smallest guy in the linebacker's room. How do you explain being the smallest guy in that room by a decent amount, by the way, and yet you lead the NFL in sacks? How does that work?
Hey, Foote, I don't know why Foote always thinking I'm the smallest guy in the room.
Is that not
he
true?
He always say that, though. No, okay. I am. But I still pretend like I'm bigger. But, yeah, I about 235, 240. But it's mindset mentality to me. I already know I'm not stronger than the person I'm going against anyway. I just got to use my skills and use, all my keys to help me to be the best that I could be. I'm not just going up and trying to manhandle him and just go straight through the guy. I just use everything. It's times where you can do that. It's times where you got to finesse. I try to keep him guessing, keep him off page, of what I'm doing, because I am a little bit small. I don't have as much power. My speed is pretty good, but it's not top end as the top people. But I just use all my surroundings and all my keys to help me succeed.
All right, so maybe Foote saying that, but your D coordinator, Todd Bowles, said this. Bowles said, quote, "I've been around some decent ones, and he does it different from all of them. Some were powerful, some were lengthy, some were fast, all were one or the other, and they were all bigger. He just knows how to play. He can finagle himself and put his body in position to make a play." So I think Todd Bowles is saying effectively what you're saying. What's it been like to play for Bowles?
Oh, amazing. Coach Bowles, he's a genius. He knows everything. He knows exactly what we need to fix. It's just up to us to fix it. I love playing in this game. Love playing for Coach Bowles, B.A., Foote, everybody. We are it's a great organization down here, and I appreciate everything he said. I just think I'm a football player. Whatever my job is, it might not be perfect at first, but the more I rep it and the more I get comfortable with it, and then it's going to be where you want it to be at, It's all about, I just think I'm a football player. I just want to be the best at whatever job it is that y'all want me to do. I don't want to be mediocre or anything. So that's, something that also drives me.
Shaq Barrett joining us. All right, to that point, as good as you are at getting after the passer, Foote was, and maybe it's a Foote thing again, he was a little concerned that you might be undersized when it came to stopping the run. But in the season opener against San Francisco, there was a play where Joe Staley was coming at you. Matt Breida was behind you. You hit Staley in the chest, and then you tackled Breida. The coaches talk about what an enormous moment that was. What do you remember about that moment? And then how much pride do you take in your ability to not only get after the quarterback, but to stop the run too?
Honestly, that felt like a normal play. Foote go back and forth all the time. He's back in Denver, you wasn't playing a run. I'm like, what film is you talking about? I thought I was playing a run back then. I thought I was a better run defender than I was a pass rusher initially. So, I don't know where that came from, but it feels like that's just making a play, manning up. It's a time when you got to go around. It's a time when you got to stand your ground, and that's, the stand your ground times. And that's part of me using my keys and knowing, reading everything, just know if it's a pass or a run, know, what kind of get off I need to have, I just use all my keys so I could be able to be prepared for whatever it is that's coming towards me. Film study, everything. I try to prepare myself as much as possible.
Now, Shaq, this offseason, the team decided to hit you with a franchise tag, not be fired up if that were to happen. What was your reaction when it was announced?
I'm excited that they want me back here. I want to be back here, so I'm excited they want me back. And I understand the use of the franchise tag. I feel it's not what I want, but they could use it, and then we still trying to work to get something done. So I understand. I want more security, but that's still a lot of money, though. If they're going to give me all that money just for 1 year with no security for them, there's no security for me either, but there's no security for them. So it could be a same situation next year. But I understand it, but I don't want it. But understand.
All right, a couple of quick things before you go. You mentioned security. Growing up was not the easiest thing necessarily for you and your brother. You're a father. Your wife, Jordana, says that you want to give your kids a life that you never had. How much fun are you having as a father, and what does it mean to be able to provide these opportunities for your kids?
It's a lot of fun being a father, just doing everything, like whatever it is. Like the kids, I love kids. Like I love kids a lot, so just imagine the love I have for my kids. So just being able to just see like the love they have, just seeing them enjoy that day, just the way they interact, it's just all amazing. I just love everything about my kids. Like I just enjoy having the time with them and playing and hanging out. Like, yeah, kids are everything.
That's awesome. That's great. Now you have this monster brand, and then you get the news that Tom Brady is joining the team. What was your reaction when that became official?
Instantly thought championship in my head when I saw that. Like instantly thought, like, yeah, we're going to the championship now. But it's still a lot of work that we got to put in. Like, we got a team, good team on paper, but paper teams never win anything. We all got to go out there. It's going to be a different type of year this year, shorten everything, I'm assuming. So it's going to be a time where we really got to put that work in and communicate and just do it, because it's not going to be given to us. Like, there's a lot of good teams out there. There's a lot of great teams out there, and not just great on paper who've been doing it for a while. So it looked good. We still got to put the work in, though.
So bottom line that for me. I mean, you're right. There's a lot of work to be done, and it's a really unusual offseason. But what's the ceiling? Like, how good can this team be? In other words, there are a lot of teams that talk about wanting to go to the Super Bowl, but now you have Tom Brady. Does that make it feel even more realistic? Is that legitimate now?
Yeah, I feel as though it's a legitimate chance for us to make it there. All we got to do is do what we're supposed to do to get us to the playoffs. Once we get in the playoffs, the sky's the limit from there. But, yeah, I'm excited about our potential down here. I was excited about all the defensive moves we was making. Like, we let one of the guys go, but it's part of the business. Like, I'm going to miss my man Carl. But, like, they doing everything that they could be doing right in my eyes, and I'm excited to be a part of it and change the mediocrity into winning and playoffs and championships.
To change that narrative completely, and what a journey it's been. He's already a Super Bowl champ, a Pro Bowler, and All-Pro. He led the NFL in sacks when 19.5, and did all of this after being undrafted out of Colorado State back in 2014. Shaq, great to have you on the show, man. That was the energy that we all needed today. I really appreciate you, and I appreciate you making time. Thanks so much.
Oh, yeah, I appreciate you having me on.
Good night now!